evening. It is Friday, January 3rd, 2020. It is 6 p.m. in the capital of the United States of America, Washington, D.C., and you are tuned to the Critical Hour here on Radio Sputnik. I'm your host, political scientist, author, and nationally syndicated columnist, Dr. Wilmer Leon. For the next hour, we will explore and analyze the salient news stories that are impacting the global village in which we live. It's Friday, so that means it's panel time, and we are joined by a frequent collaborator with all major news outlets and author of City Builders and Vandals in Our Age, Caleb Maupin. Caleb, as always, welcome back.
Thank you, and glad to be here.
We're joined by co-founder of Black Alliance for Peace and former vice presidential nominee for the Green Party, Ajamu Baraka. Ajamu, welcome.
My pleasure.
And we're joined by international affairs and security analyst Mark Sloboda. Mark, welcome back.
Dr. Leon, thanks for having me. It's always an honor and a pleasure to be on the Critical Hour.
Qasem Soleimani, the son of a laborer who became Iran's most revered military commander, was assassinated yesterday in a targeted U.S. drone airstrike at the airport in Iraq. In the immediate aftermath of his death, Iranian politicians said it would have been Soleimani's dream to be martyred by the U.S., Iran's arch foe, which he had relentlessly battled in the Middle East for more than two decades, and that he also led the elite Quds force. One of the fiercest military commanders in Iran in recent decades, the 62-year-old had long masterminded Iran's support for Shia militant groups, so close to Iran's supreme leader that he saw him as a son, Ayatollah Ali Khamenei, said the death was bitter for Iran, but he vowed revenge, which would make it more bitter for the U.S. What does all of this mean, Caleb Maupin?
Well, I think more than anything, this shows Donald Trump coming from a position of complete weakness. You know, Donald Trump, his supporters saw him as a strong guy who was going to come in there and drain the swamp. But it appears that Donald Trump is facing an impeachment, and he's facing a reelection in 2020, and he is very, very afraid of not having the support from neocons in his own party. He's very, very afraid of losing the support of his Saudi friends and the Kingdom of Saudi Arabia, the autocratic monarchy. He's afraid. He wants to make sure he has the support of the Likud party faction in Israel and Netanyahu and Sheldon Adelson and others. And so in response to Trump's real fears, he engaged in a very, very provocative action and killed one of the main enemies of ISIS and al-Qaeda. Let's remember this. Al-Qaeda has tried to kill Soleimani on many occasions and failed. ISIS has tried to kill Soleimani on many occasions and failed. But what ISIS and al-Qaeda failed to do has now been done by the United States. And rather than stand up to Saudi Arabia, the fountainhead of Wahhabi terrorism, rather than, you know, expose the fact that that terrorist networks were built in Syria and that the very kind of forces that have killed Americans are getting covertly supported by the Saudis, rather than doing that, we've got the president of the United States, you know, taking an opposite move and desperately saying, please don't impeach me. Please make sure I get reelected. And taking a very, very dramatic move that is likely to spark a huge, huge international crisis. It seems to have already done that, but we're seeing the results playing out before our eyes.
Ajamu Baraka, your thoughts?
I think that the analysis that suggests that this is a act of weakness is a correct one. I would just add that it's quite clear to me that the decision was not only just driven by some domestic political considerations, but it also represents, in terms of weakness, a final capitulation to those forces within the foreign policy establishment that always wanted to have some kind of conflict with Iran. So it's a complete reversal of his campaign rhetoric and a triumph, if you will, for the quote-unquote deep state. So the credentials of Trump being someone trying to extricate the U.S. from these ongoing wars, that narrative has now been completely eliminated.
Mark Sloboda.
I think we have to remember, I don't think it's good to overplay the domestic political context of this as yet. We have to remember that Donald Trump while he did campaign on ending regime change wars and improving relations with Russia, he and his immediate own circle, even before the neocons were brought in to his administration, were always extremely hawkish, even rabid on Iran. So this is actually fairly consistent Trump from the beginning. And in the last days, the U.S., I think, is extremely upset that its economic war against Iran hasn't brought the country to its knees yet, and that the latest round of protests, which some say the U.S. had a hand in, were unsuccessful in another color revolution attempt against the Iranian government. We have a fragile political situation in Iraq, and the U.S. is extremely upset about Iranian influence in Iraq, about many Iraqis, democracy, now having been brought to Iraq by the U.S. overthrow of Saddam Hussein. You have a Shia majority that no small number of them gravitate for cultural, religious, and other reasons towards Iran. They see them as a natural partner across the border. The Trump administration, the U.S. Government, is extremely unhappy about this and about Iranian influence in the possible formation of a new Iraqi government and prime minister. And recently, U.S. officials, including Esper, the Secretary of Defense, have spoken that demanding that Iraqis need to purge the Iraqi government of Iranian influence, because I guess only American influence is allowed in Iraq. I think this is, to an extent, what this is. This is Donald Trump acting on behalf of the U.S., literally lifting up his leg and pissing all over Iraq to mark it as American territory, saying that Iranian influence will not be tolerated here. And this is the kind of insane goal from halfway around the world that they have set on themselves. They think that they can keep Iraqis and Iranians from cooperating with each other. And this latest incidence of this is not going to work. In fact, I think it's going to have the opposite effect. Not only in this attack was Soleimani killed,
right,
but several Iraqi citizens, including an Iraqi military commander, the deputy commander of the popular mobilization units, which were instrumental, as even Barack Obama recognized, in defending Baghdad and defeating ISIS in Iraq and Syria. And these were organized and helped trained by Soleimani and the Quds Force. So Soleimani is also recognized as a hero by many Iraqis. He's revered in Iraq as well as Iran. And they also killed Iraqi military officials in a sovereign country, against the wishes, as far as anyone knows, of the government and certainly of most of the Iraqi people. And right now, the Iraqi parliament is meeting, and the number one thing they're debating, and it seems pretty consistent, is to kick the United States once again, U.S. military forces, out of Iraq, which will almost certainly mean that Iran will gain even more influence in the country. So I think this is not just the military blowback, because Iran is sure to respond in some form or another, be that a quid pro quo targeted assassination or military strikes against U.S. Bases in the Middle East. I think there's going to be a political and geopolitical blowback as U.S. influence in the region is brought down if Iraq ends up kicking the U.S. out of Iraq for this blatant violation of their sovereignty.
Ajamu Baraka, back in June, Donald Trump greenlit limited airstrikes against radar stations and missile batteries in Iran. Then at the very last minute, it is reported that he abruptly called them off against the advice of Pompeo and then National Security Advisor Bolton. And there are those who argue that when Trump did that, he really upset the hawkish elite, those who have been just rabid against foaming at the mouth to attack Iran, and that this strike against General Soleimani was really Trump's way of trying to regain favor with the hawkish side of the elite who had really wondered if they could trust Donald Trump. Your thoughts?
Well, I mean, I think that I understand that position. I don't really see it in that way. I do see a consistent effort on the part of elements in the foreign policy establishment who are advocating for a stronger policy toward Iran that Donald Trump and his advisors, at least some of them, were somewhat resistant to. But I think that this is where the domestic politics intersects with the international. I think it's a consequence of the impeachment spectacle and the alignment that he was trying to avoid of ruling class elements that were plotting his possible demise. He has been systematically granting elements of the agenda to them, including this aggressive response to Iran. So, you know, and we saw it coming. It wasn't just last June, but with the compromise that took place recently with the military budget, with the NDAA, mm-hmm. where they stripped out of the legislation any restrictions against him waging war against Iran. We saw it coming, and this is, I think, the consequence. But it's unfortunate that for U.S. policymakers, this move is really counterproductive in the longer term. It makes no sense because it's clear that there's political pressure now on the Iraqi parliament to expel U.S. forces. It's going to, in fact, strengthen the Iranians in the long term in terms of their positions in their own region.
Caleb Maupin, Secretary of State Pompeo said that the U.S. airstrike that killed General Soleimani was to disrupt an imminent attack, his words, from the top Iranian commander that could have cost American lives in the Middle East. He said, "I can't talk too much about the nature of the threats, but the American people should know that the president's decision to remove Soleimani from the battlefield saved American lives. We've been lied to before. It was huge lies that got us into the ouster of Saddam Hussein in Iraq, and we now are still bogged down in that quagmire. Why won't Americans think that they're lying to us again?"
Well, indeed. And I mean, at this point, we don't know what Iran's response is going to be as of yet. We understand that the Supreme National Security Council held an emergency meeting and made what they call difficult decisions. And it was announced that at the right time, in the right place, they will take revenge, essentially. We don't know what that means. We don't know what that will look like. However, if it is as dramatic as it most likely will be, it's then expected the United States will take revenge for the revenge. And this is how things spiral way out of control. This is a very, very dangerous, dangerous situation. And for Pompeo to be walking around American TV networks, as he has been, and on social media, trying to say that somehow this was a de-escalatory measure, I'm sorry, but who is he kidding? I mean, who is he kidding? Some people have compared this to, say, oh, imagine that a top general in the United States, like Mattis, was killed or something. That's not even an accurate comparison.
No.
I mean, Soleimani was second only to the Supreme Leader. He was like, I mean, this guy is one of the most beloved people in the Islamic Republic of Iran, the national hero. I mean, this is a huge dramatic move. And, you know, you want to talk about domestic impact. You can talk about the fact that the oil price shot up by 4% this morning in response to this incident, right? That's certainly good for Trump's pals in the fracking companies. And it's certainly been good for Betsy DeVos and her military contractors and her brother Eric Prince. And it's certainly been good for Bernie Marcus, who's tied in with the military contractors. And they're in the Trump camp. But internationally, though, and in Iran specifically, it is the hardliner faction that is winning the argument here. You know, Rouhani was elected after the defeat of Ahmadinejad in the election. He came in. He said, "We're going to negotiate with the United States." And it seems like everything the Trump administration has done, ripping up the Iran deal, waging all-out economic warfare, and now killing, you know, the national hero of the country, is reinforcing the argument made by the hardliners in Iran that the United States could not be trusted, that the United States is Shaitan e Bazorg, the great Satan. and that that the only response to the United States needs to be a military one and a place of strength. I mean, all the forces that put their effort into negotiations and the Iran deal and all of that have got to be really, really blown away by seeing everything they worked for just go down in flames. I mean, this is such a U-turn, and in the end, you have to wonder, I mean, what will Iran's response be? What will the response of the United States be to Iran's response? And is there a way out of this? Now, I see rumors on social media, unconfirmed, that Russia and China are talking with Iranian leaders and trying to get them to give a response that will not lead to a third world war. And I hope that that is the case. And I hope that that there are some people, you know, in the White House and in the Pentagon and in the intelligence agencies of the United States who are also saying, let's not let this spin out of control. This is a situation that is extremely, extremely dangerous. The implications here are very, very big. I mean, I don't recall a situation in recent history that had this much potential to lead to, you know, something really, really horrific. I mean, you know, I could see something like this spinning out of control into a nuclear war. I'm not exaggerating.
I know you're not, and I think you're right. Mark Sloboda, we have about 2 minutes left. Context of discussion or so-called analysis is very important, and we're hearing repeatedly on the corporate media, morally, it was a solid move. Tactically, it was a blunder. Elizabeth Warren said Soleimani was a murderer responsible for the deaths of thousands, including hundreds of Americans. But this reckless move escalates the situation with Iran and increases the likelihood of more deaths and new Middle East conflict. Where on the other hand, Bernie Sanders says this was an assassination. It's dangerous. Trump's dangerous escalation brings us closer to another disastrous war. As I've been listening to media all day today, their lack of context. Oh, the American relationship with Iran spun out of control in 1976, forgetting, of course, about the overthrow of Mohammad Mossadegh in 53. So this context is, or lack of context, is nauseating and incredibly scary.
Yeah, I mean, the U.S., anyone from the U.S., U.S. politicians, officials, speaking of Soleimani as he has a blood on his hands is really a little too much hypocrisy to bear, considering the recent history of the U.S. In the Middle East, the invasion and military occupation of Iraq, the tantamount destruction of Libya, the support of the Saudi invasion and genocide in Yemen, the jihadi proxy war, and now overt military occupation of East Syria. U.S. officials speaking of Soleimani as having blood on his hands, as if they don't, is a bit much to bear. And also blaming Soleimani principally for Iraqi resistance to the U.S. military invasion and occupation of their country, which is what they're talking about there, the idea that Iran helped with IED technology, the only one the U.S. has to blame for U.S. military deaths in Iraq is the U.S. government. That is the only one responsible for that. It's really amazing how already the media is really dovetailing behind Trump here. And we've seen Democratic politicians from Pete Buttigieg running for the presidency on the Democratic ticket to Elizabeth Warren's to others jumping behind Trump, because there really is bipartisan consensus in the U.S. for demonization of Iran, for conflict with Iran. And, you know, this is just one part of the U.S. pursuit of global hegemony in the Mideast with the U.S. allies, the dictatorship of Saudi Arabia and Israel, which are certainly both quite eager to see American boys and girls die in a war against Iran for them.
I got to stop you there. Caleb Maupin, Jammu Baraka, and that was just the voice of Mark Sloboda. Gentlemen, thank you all for your time today. As always, your contribution to the Critical Hour. Happy New Year to you all in spite of all of this turmoil, and look forward to having you all back.
Thank you.
Thank you. You are listening to the Critical Hour on Radio Sputnik. I'm your host, Dr. Wilmer Leon. There is more on the other side. Stay tuned. We are back, and you're listening to The Critical Hour on Radio Sputnik. I'm your host, Dr. Wilmer Leon. It's Friday, and as I said in the first segment, it's panel time. We're joined by an associate professor of economics at the University of Missouri, Kansas City, Dr. Linwood Taheed. Linwood, welcome back.
Thank you. It's always a pleasure.
We're joined by a political analyst and commentator and editor of The Polemicist. His latest piece can be found at Counterpunch and The Polemicist. It is entitled Eve of Destruction, Iran Strikes Back. Jim Kavanaugh. Jim, welcome.
Thanks.
And we're joined by a journalist and author of three books, The Frozen Republic, The Velvet Coup, and America's Undeclared War, Daniel Lazar. Daniel, welcome.
My pleasure.
I'm going to start with Jim. Jim, you have been on this program and been very consistent for a number of months saying that the United States is going to war with Iran. The events that took place last night with the assassination of General Soleimani, is this getting us closer to your unfortunate prediction?
Yeah, well, I think it's not even closer. I mean, this is an act of war by anybody's standards. You know, it's equivalent. In fact, it's war equivalent. I read a thing from Trita Parsi, who's an American-Iranian analyst, who said, you know, I talked to my senior officials in Iran and said to them, this is like someone would Iranians would have assassinated Petraeus or Mattis. And they said, no, it's much worse than that. You know, Soleimani was probably the most popular figure in Iran. He was a kind of hero, not just to the Iranians, but for many people in the Middle East, for, you know, being the leader of the fight against ISIS, one of the most effective leaders in the fight against ISIS. So this is unmistakable and must be answered aggression against the Iranian state. And, you know, that article you mentioned was actually from 6 months ago where I started to talk about this, and I've been talking about it in every article since. This is the dynamic that's been a lot of things, and it's very, very dangerous because the Americans, and Trump especially, I think, is being fooled by people who think they can get away with the escalation dominance game. You know, we can escalate this to a certain point, and they, Iran in this case, will be afraid to escalate it any further. And Iran has been saying, and that's what I started to say in that article, since June, since Trump, you know, started this maximum pressure campaign, we are not going to back down. We are going to respond to everything you do as much as we can. They know they can be hurt by the United States and Israel, but they also know that the United States and Israel can't take casualties, and they can't take much damage before the political will starts to collapse. And Iran is in this, and they're gonna respond, and people better get used to this. This is the start of, we're already in it. We are at war with Iran. They've considered themselves at war since Trump started the maximum pressure thing, and now everybody in the world better recognize we are at war with Iran.
You mentioned how revered General Soleimani was and still is. Let me tell you, folks in this country listening in, they have absolutely no clue. I was in Iran in February of 2016 for the commemoration of the revolution. And I'm standing on a corner just taking in all of this celebration, and a group of about 10 people walk past me and step into the street and start walking down the street, leisurely down the street, and the whole place goes nuts. And I turned to my interpreter. I said, Ali, who is that? Ali looked at me almost with tears in his eyes. That's General Soleimani. That's General Soleimani. And I said, who in the world is General Soleimani? And he said, our greatest general. They call him the ghost. I had my camera, and I leaned down to pick up my camera out of my bag to take a picture. And when I got up level, he was gone. And I said, Ali, why y'all call him the ghost? He said, where is he now? Daniel Lazar.
The mind reels. It's an incredible act by Trump and an incredible act of recklessness. It opens up. I hate to quote Joe Biden, but he was on the money when he said it's akin to tossing a
stick of dynamite into a tinderbox.
Mm-hmm.
And it's a 1914 moment. I mean, there's no trouble coming up with a list of a half dozen countries or more that could be drawn into the conflagration, which could extend from the, you know, from the Persian Gulf to the Mediterranean and down to the Red Sea as well. It's a disaster. Now, when Trump said that it was akin to throwing dynamite into a tinderbox, the next question is, well, why is it a tinderbox? Who made it that way? And the answer is very clear. Responsibility, the overwhelming responsibility lies with the U.S. By some estimates, by my own back-of-the-envelope calculations, the U.S. has invested something in the order of $18 to $20 trillion in military buildups in the Persian Gulf. It has turned the Gulf region into the greatest military weaponry entrepot in the world. Saudi Arabia, I think, has the third largest military budget in the world. Relative to GDP, it spends 2 to 3 times as much as Israel. And all these incredible amounts of arms and weapons and bombs, et cetera, have not made the Persian Gulf any more peaceful. To the contrary, it has turned it into a giant powder keg. And now the fear is that powder keg is about to explode. And believe me, if it doesn't happen tomorrow or the next day or the day after, the lesson of this is that it's going to happen sooner or later. The U.S. and Iran are on a collision course to war. It is entirely America's fault, and it's going to be a disaster.
Dr. Linwood Taheed, your thoughts when you heard last night that Qassem Soleimani had been assassinated?
My thoughts were that the neocons are winning. You will remember that it wasn't that long ago that Trump attempted, or at least promised, to pull troops out of Syria. That was immediately met by both Republicans and Democrats with aghast, and he backed down on that. He, promised to bring troops out of Syria back to the U.S., but instead promised to redeploy them to Saudi Arabia. And so the Saudi Arabian connection, of course, is clear. Iran and the Shia Muslims there are the historical enemies in that region of Saudi Arabia and the Sunnis. And so in this time when the Sunnis, when the MBS and others can pay the U.S. to become a mercenary force in order to confront Syria on their behalf, then the people should be well aware that we're looking at a situation in which the Sunni Muslim regime in Saudi Arabia and Israel is directing U.S. foreign policy. Now, that's not necessarily a new thing in that region, but it is so blatant by being juxtaposed to the president that promised to end all of these wars and attempted to pull troops out of Syria, but there was a heavy pushback, not just from Democrats, but also from Democrats and Republicans who are unified in the idea that war must continue to go on. And so my thoughts are that the neocons are winning, perhaps have won completely, because this is, as the other guests have said, an escalation that's unlikely to be resolved except in warfare.
Jim Kavanaugh, as I've been listening to analysis today through mainstream media, I am aghast, but not surprised, but still aghast at the ahistorical lack of context that all of this has been put into. You've got Elizabeth Warren saying that Soleimani was a murderer responsible for the deaths of thousands, including hundreds of Americans, but this reckless move escalates the situation with Iran. I've been hearing a number of people say, well, morally, the United States was justified in putting this murderer to death, but tactically, this really just wasn't the time to do it. You've got Joe Biden saying basically the same thing, that Soleimani was a murderer, but tactically, it was a bad move. Totally ignoring the reality, as they say on the corner, don't start nothing, won't be nothing, that this really is the United States. Just once again, since 1953, just continuing to stick its finger in the eye of the bear and then wondering why it gets its hand bit off. The ahistorical context of this so-called analysis, I had to turn it off last night. It was so nauseating.
I can't watch it for more than 10 minutes at a time. Yeah, I mean, this, he has blood on his hands. He's been killing Americans. What are you talking about? First of all, every military leader has blood on his hands. That's the job, okay? Secondly, the only Americans Soleimani could be said to have some hand in killing were the American invaders in Iraq that Soleimani helped some of the Iraqi resistance fight against, okay? That's fair game. That's warfare. It's the war that the Americans started. Thirdly, he was the most effective ally of whoever it was, insofar as the United States was doing it, and certainly the Iraqi government, in fighting against the ISIS. The blood on his hands is the blood of ISIS. So, you know, what are you complaining about? This and this morally superior attitude, again, this is what people, this sanctimonious crap, excuse my friend, this is what people in the rest of the world look at and say, come on, give me a break. The United States is rampaging around the world. So, and all of these people who are saying that, as you say, this is a tactical problem. Oh, he should have notified us first. Or he should have signed, he should have gotten our permission. We would have given the permission. You know, this is a horrible, there are reasons why this is stricken from permissible acts of warfare or of diplomacy of whatever it is. Iran is not about to attack the United States. Soleimani is not about to attack the United States. Anybody can start assassinating foreign leaders. This is a game that nobody should want to play. But now this is a game that's the United States has initiated and everybody can play. Every American president and every American general has thousands of times more blood on their hands than did Soleimani. And the Iranian regime right now has the right to target all of them. And who can complain morally? I mean, this is just disgraceful to hear this kind of talk. This is not politics. This is American sanctimony being presented as if it were politics. And it's getting us into a disaster again.
And Daniel Lazar, staying with the same question, but picking up on Jim's point about that Iran is not about to attack the U.S., it's always amusing to me in listening to Donald Trump, listening to Barack Obama, listening to American presidents and secretaries of state, they always speak in the context of the United States and its interests. And so they always put this in the context of U.S. interests needing to be protected.
Yes, of course. I mean, first of all, let's bear in mind that Iran is on the Persian Gulf. Saudi Arabia borders on the Persian Gulf, and America is 8,000 miles away. So America, this is not taking place in America's neighborhood. It's taking place, America is intruding in someone else's neighborhood. And number two, there's little doubt that since Jimmy Carter announced the famous Carter Doctrine, which extended U.S. military hegemony over the entire Persian Gulf, And he and Zbigniew Brzezinski, with help from the Saudis, essentially invented modern jihad. Jihad is a Sunni phenomenon, and so therefore the U.S. has done as much as anybody, if not more, to ramp up sectarian warfare in the region. And that sectarian warfare has been disastrous. And essentially, it has brought Iran, as the major Shiite power in the area, you know, into conflict with its neighbors. But Iran didn't do this voluntarily. Iran was drawn in ineluctably by the U.S. And in 2007, we know that there was the so-called redirection, the title of a famous article by Seymour Hersh in the New Yorker, in which the U.S. decided to lay off al-Qaeda for a while and focus on allying itself with the Saudis against various Shiite interests in the region, which, of course, are always backed by Iran. So the U.S. has done its best to create this sectarian nightmare, and for which it then blames Iran, the primary victim. Now, Iran has had no choice but to combat this U.S.-Saudi Sunni offensive, and it's acquired allies in Syria, Iraq, Lebanon, Yemen, et cetera. But there's little question that historically its actions were primarily defensive rather than offensive. And so now it's being drawn into the greatest battle of them all with the United States. And the region, which has already been burnt over once, twice, or three times, is now about to go up in flames again. And as I said, responsibility lies squarely on one party, and that is America.
And Linwood, same point to you, but I want to throw in, since Daniel mentioned Jimmy Carter, I think it was 96 when they were trying to figure out what to do with the Shah. And the Shah, I think, was in Mexico and wanting to come to the United States. And it was John Rockefeller, the head of Standard Oil and Chase Bank, that convinced Jimmy Carter that the Shah was so sick that the only place that he could seek his medical treatment would be here in the United States. And it was Rockefeller convincing Jimmy Carter, who did not want to bring the Shah to the United States, that this is where he had to come. And that was just another element that a lot of people don't talk about why the Iranians are not happy with the United States. There's so much history here of the United States just flat out not only invading these people, not only overthrowing their government, but just insulting them flat out.
Yes, of course, the major economic interests for the U.S. is oil in the Mideast. This has been the commanding asset that the U.S. has sought during for all of the 20th century, and will be the doom of the West and perhaps the world if we continue to use fossil fuels. But let's not forget that Soleimani was killed in an airstrike in Iraq, and since that time there have been protests at the American embassy in Iraq. That Iraq itself, even though it was dictated for a long time by Saddam Hussein, who was a Sunni Muslim, is mostly, I think, two-thirds Shia. And so we have Iraq and its neighbor, Iran, which is a mostly predominantly Shia community that is now being put in opposition to Saudi Arabia. And Saudi Arabia is also, of course, engaged in a war in Yemen. And so the region is escalating. It's catching fire. And the U.S. is in the middle of all of this. And so there's Syria, there's Iraq, there's Iran, there's Yemen. And that pretty much takes care of all of that territory there. Particularly if you look at the movement of Turkey into Syria, pretty much at the invitation of the Trump administration, or some say by the threat by Erdogan against the Trump administration because of information that Erdogan has about the Khashoggi killing, and so there's a ham-handedness that's taking place. And in prior times, that ham-handedness, because of overwhelming U.S. military dominance, the U.S. could lose a couple of hundred lives and then take care of the situation. But the warfare is much more asymmetrical. Iraq is an example of that. Iraq did not fold. It did not fall to the shock and awe. It is still a problem. And here again, I want to still juxtapose that to a president who campaigned on bringing troops home, of ending senseless wars. And if it's anything that should be senseless to the Trump administration supporters, who are evangelicals, who are nationalists is the idea of fighting a war on the behalf of Muslims against other Muslims.
Jim Kavanaugh, final point to you as we get into this brief break. One, to Linwood's point, sending troops now, the report is 3,000 more troops are going to be sent to the Mideast after all this discussion about bringing them out of Afghanistan. And we were saying last week, hey, folks, they're not coming home. We don't know where they're going, but they're not coming here. And now we know where they're going. But to this point of Pompeo saying that we got intelligence that Soleimani was going to, you know, act against the United States, and so we had to act on the intelligence. It seems to be selective intelligence gathering or selective intelligence interpretation and action. They got intelligence because Khashoggi was going to be murdered. They did nothing about that. There's been a lot of operational intelligence that the United States seems to ignore, but all of a sudden, this intelligence on Soleimani had to be acted upon. And just another quick historical point of context for people, I want to say that George W. Bush, they had Soleimani in their sights during the George W. Bush administration. They got intelligence that we can pull the trigger on him right now. And George W. Bush said, nah, that's not a fuse I want to light right now. So this goes back, way back. And other presidents have been a little more reserved than the current president. Jim Kavanaugh, and then we got to get out.
Yeah, well, yes. Soleimani, first of all, this Soleimani, everybody knew he was going to be there. This was a public thing. He there was no secret he was going to be there. They could have gotten Soleimani to say many times. And this was a decision, had nothing to do with some secret plan he had to attack Americans tomorrow. This was a decision to escalate the war that was pushed, as Linwood is saying, by the neocons. And we have to recognize something here. There is a party in this situation that wants this war, that has always wanted this war, and that is Israel. They want a war with Iran. You can read it in the New York Times. You can read it in the Washington Post over the past year. Long articles about how frantic Netanyahu has been to try and get the Americans to go to war with Iran for him because they don't want to do it themselves. They got the Americans to attack Iraq. They got the Americans to attack Libya. They got the Americans to attack Syria. And they're getting the Americans to attack Iran. And it's Trump. It's showing that you can't be anti-war and end the reckless, endless wars if you're still sticking with the Zionist program, because Israel wants to get rid of all of the possible axes of resistance. And Soleimani represented a lot of the remaining axis of resistance. And that's what the United States decided to do.
You are listening to The Critical Hour here on Radio Sputnik. I'm your host, Dr. Wilmer Leon. There is more on the other side. Stay tuned. We are back, and you're listening to The Critical Hour on Radio Sputnik. I'm your host, Dr. Wilmer Leon. It's Friday, and it's panel time, and we have with us Daniel Lazar. We have with us Jim Kavanaugh and Dr. Linwood Taheed. Gentlemen, thank you so much for staying with me.
Pleasure.
Thank you.
I want to take this assassination of General Soleimani and put it in a slightly larger international context. And I think that was Jim Kavanaugh that was talking about how Israel has been pushing for a war between the United States and Iran for ad nauseum. But France has weighed in here and said, bad move, folks. We're starting to get some other international responses from this. We've got China and Russia that I believe are counseling Iran, saying, now's not the time, fellas, now's not the time. Your thoughts, Linwood Taheed, on the broader international implications on this? The stock market is down, for example.
What we are seeing here, I believe, is an evaluation of international leaders, leaders of France and other European countries, of the Trump administration and its haphazard foreign policy. There's no pretense that the Trump administration can make that this is a well-considered policy, that they had to do this.
Don't forget that Trump is in the middle of an impeachment. I mean, he's been impeached, but he's now going over to trial at some point in the Senate. And what has been said on this program times before is that it was an expectation that Trump would possibly go to war in order to be seen as a wartime president to boost his popularity during a reelection year. This is something that he himself has commented that he was afraid that Barack Obama would do during his presidency. So he was already conditioned to do this. And so he's thinking of this as a win, as a purely political move. There's no reason for Macron or Johnson or any of the other leaders of European powers to follow him into this folly.
Same question to you, Daniel Lazar, adding the point about what could the end move be here? I mean, one would hope, one would think, one would pray that when an American president pushes a button on another country's general, that there is a perception of winnable option. That, you know, you got to look at Donald Trump and say, man, what the hell are you doing? And why are you doing this? I mean, and I know that's very rhetorical, but what's the strategy? Where's the win here?
There is no strategy. This policy makes no sense at all. I mean, bear in mind, the U.S. has been a net energy exporter since, I think, 2012. So the U.S. doesn't even need Persian Gulf oil anymore. The only reason it wants to control the Persian Gulf is to prevent Russia or China or Iran from controlling it instead. So the U.S. is engaged in a pure power play, a pure geopolitical move. It wants to control the Persian Gulf, because that's the source of 20% of the world's hydrocarbons, and just because it's there. So the policy makes no sense. It hasn't made sense for decades, but the U.S. has followed it regardless. And I think the other countries are quite terrified. I mean, what will France, what will Britain do if a general 1914-style conflagration breaks out in the Persian Gulf? I mean, if there's a war, there will be an upsurge of terrorism. There will be a refugee crisis on the scale of 2015, if not greater. The EU will be inundated once again. Internal politics will be turned upside down once again. So everyone is quite terrified as to where this is all leading. But there seems to be no way to stop it. And the Europeans, by the way, could have opposed Trump more forcefully in demanding that he stand by the JCPOA, the 2015 nuclear accord with Iran. They could have done much more to buck U.S. trade sanctions, but they didn't do a damn thing, not a damn thing. So Iran has paid a huge price. Its oil exports are down to virtually zero. Its economy is in extreme crisis. It's desperate. It's up against the wall. And now the U.S. has hit it with this extraordinary provocation in the form of an assassination of its foremost general. And it's hard to imagine how Iran cannot, you know, respond in kind.
Jim Kavanaugh, you know, to that point, if this is for regime change, attacking a country, from what I've observed, has the way of heightening nationalism. It has the way of creating the scenario for those in power. Look, it's us against them. Y'all need to support us. I don't see how regime change comes out of this. And now, with the sanctions imposed, now it to a great degree, it almost becomes a badge of honor for Iranians to endure this pain, because they're now not only under economic attack, it's a declaration of war.
Yeah, there is a war. Look, the Iranians fought a war, one of the most deadly wars in history. They lost 1 million people in the war that the Americans and the Saudis and the Israelis pushed Iraq to attack Iran. So they're ready to fight a war, and they're ready to be united. And just to go back to the point about the international repercussions, this is one of the reasons why they don't like Trump, because he's perceived as being reckless and impetuous and not having a strategy. They need someone who can lead an aggression against Iran in a way that talks well, in a way that looks good, that can get up on the world stage and explain it and get the European leaders to go along with it. And Trump is not that guy. This is one of the things I've said. I think that's been one of the main reasons why they want to get rid of Trump to begin with. And he'll end up doing what they want, but he won't do it in a way that's helpful to them. And as Dan said, the Europeans here have, you know, the responsibility to oppose this, but I don't think they're going to. And they're more likely to do with Trump in place than not. But certainly you're right. The Iranians are not going to back down on this. As a people, they're not going to back down on this. And the point of it isn't actually to change the regime. The point of it is to do what was done in Syria and Iraq. Change the regime, yes, but really just to weaken the country, to increase sectarianism, to have a bunch of Arab and Muslims fighting each other all around the place, and to make these countries weak and incapable of resisting the plans of Israel, first of all, the United States and Saudi Arabia also.
You know, there was a saying about George W. Bush. You mentioned reckless Jim Cavanaugh. They used to say that George Bush was as reckless as a monkey with a razor blade. And this now, I don't know if Trump then would be a gorilla with a razor blade or a machete or what. Linwood Tahid, as indicators are that we're moving towards a recession, what does this do, if anything, to a pending recession in the United States?
Well, what this does to politically, the signs of moving into a recession means that the Trump administration could not rely on a quote good economy as a positive point in a reelection. So there's the alternative to that is to go to war, to be seen as a wartime president. But what that does reflexively back on the American people, of course, you mentioned the stock market is down. What that means is that corporations are viewing that their future value will be less than current value. So that would seem to mean that business leaders are looking at an increasing probability of a greater recession. And so for the U.S. to go on a wartime footing, particularly when a recession was on the horizon, may increase the popularity of a wartime president, but will certainly heighten the possibility of recession. And to your other point, the idea that when a country is attacked or even goes on the attack in warfare, that will lead to an increased popularity of the leadership in that country is a very opposite way of thinking that if the U.S. attacks Iran, somehow Iran will fall, that there will be regime change. No, there's going to be the same response in Iran among Iranians for being attacked. They're going to unify and consolidate. And as Jim Kavanaugh, I believe it was Jim who said, they were willing to lose a million people in a war with Iraq, and they're willing to do that again in a war against the U.S.
Daniel Azar, I'm just exacerbated. I think that's the word. Exasperated. That's the word. Exasperated. Behind all of this, what do you say to the Elizabeth Warrens of the world and to the Joe Bidens of the world and other Democrats that want to back the president on this move and champion this? Bernie Sanders is, from what I can discern, one of the few out there in terms of prominent candidates who says, not only bad move, this was an assassination, as in disagreeing that Soleimani had to go.
I mean, I think Sanders is right. This is, I think that Warren's statement, Adam Schiff said the same thing. Biden did, of course, as well. I mean, these are astonishing statements. And, and America is just incapable of any kind of self-scrutiny, self-criticism, any kind of critical evaluation of its own acts. I mean, America is always right and the other guy is always wrong. It's just maddening. But this is the way countries think when they're drunk with power,
when they can't imagine ever being defeated. You know, I think I said earlier, it's a 1914 moment.
I wanted to get back to that because that was the assassination of Archduke Franz Ferdinand that led us into World War One.
Yeah. But I just want to point out that by the time that war was over, 4 years later, four major royal dynasties collapsed. You know, the Austro-Hungarian, Hungarians, the Ottoman Turks, the Hohenzollerns in Berlin, and the Romanovs, of course, in Russia. So if a conflagration breaks out here, we're going to see the same thing happen. The first victim will be the House of Saud. That's already a dynasty that is just like, you know, walking on eggshells. But other regimes will collapse as well as the chaos spreads. But I want to emphasize that there's one very important regime which could find itself in deep trouble if this war turns really ugly, and that is the United States. The U.S. economy is poised for a recession. The system is rotten and corrupt through and through. The quality of leadership in Washington on both sides of the aisle is abysmal, and the people are seething with anger. So if the U.S. gets its fingers badly burned in the Middle East, if things go badly for it, you could see major repercussions at home, as we saw during Vietnam. The U.S. could really just politically explode.
Let me stop you there. That was the voice of Daniel Lazar. We were also joined by Jim Kavanaugh, as well as Dr. Linwood Tahi. Gentlemen, as always, thank you for your time, for participating in this panel, and greatly appreciate your insight on this incredibly, incredibly dangerous day. All right, folks, you've been listening to The Critical Hour here on Radio Sputnik. Thank you for allowing my voice into your space. I hope you were informed and enlightened. I look forward to talking with you all right here next week on Radio Sputnik. Be safe. Peace and blessings. I'm out.